This is Mike Miller, and you're here with me on the Harmony Street Show, and it's my pleasure to have as my guest today R&B legend, Mr. Ingredient, Mr. Cuba Gooding. How you doing, Cuba?
I'm doing great, and like the lyric said to my most largest selling song to date, everybody plays the fool sometime. Not all the time, but sometime. And I think this interview will belly that.
Absolutely. Good days and bad days. So let's get right down to it. You were born where?
I was born in Harlem, New York, a hospital called Sydenham Hospital, which is now a nursing home. But when I was little, I was born in 1944, in the middle of the war.
Right.
And I think war babies might have some sort of spiritual or some sort of meaningful connotation, because we're born in the middle of legalized and acceptable murder. And my concept, when I was born, my parents did not want me to be of that number of negativity. The positive musical thing that they brought me to, regardless of their background, so my mother came out of the Deep South. My dad came out of the Caribbean, Barbados, and he had been a slave there and came to America, met my mom, and on, you know, so they had had rocky beginnings, and they wanted mine to be as smooth as silk if they possibly could. And
right.
Harlem that I came up in was like a Shangri-La for music, for entertainment. Superstars would come from everywhere into Harlem and hang out, perform, and gamble, and do what they will, but you know, I'm a show business baby.
Right, the best
and
of the best.
And Harlem was where I was born. And so I've been trying ever since to, I didn't have to instill it into my children, but I had to try to instill it into the individuals that they chose to marry.
Right. No, I understand.
which is a whole other story. But anyway, I was born in Harlem, New York. And anyone who looks it up knows what that means.
Right. No. I understand. Now, it's been said that you used to sing yourself to sleep when you were a kid.
That's why my mom and dad made that. Mostly my mom, because my dad died when I was 11. My mom was interested in me because of my father's influence on her and her mindset with regard to survival, because she had to raise two boys after he left. He
right.
said, you must have the mindset of an immigrant.
Right. No, I understand
and
that.
And, of course, I don't think my mom understood what he meant by immigrant. He didn't just mean African-American immigrant. He also meant a Hispanic immigrant, a Jewish immigrant,
right.
an Irish immigrant. Most immigrants come to America because it is the closest thing to the land of milk and honey that they can find.
Right.
And if they're Christian in any way, whether it's Catholic or whatever, they believed that when they came to New York, they'd be allowed to earn a living, not as employees, not as servants, but as entrepreneurs. And my mom told my dad all the time, you come to New York, you come to America in particular, but New York specifically to become an entrepreneur. You
right.
don't come to punch a clock. You don't come to work on a job. My dad never did. And so my mom wanted to find something I could do without punching the clock. And pass it on to my brother, who also opened, like he became big in the airline business. But
right.
my parents wanted us to surpass what they had accomplished. And I think that's the point I'm trying to make, because that's what the Cuba Gooding story is about. We all wanted to be, we didn't frown on what we had done, but we wanted the innocent children that we brought to this planet, by no fault of their own. We all wanted our children to surpass us in every way possible. And that's what the Gooding Development Doctrine has always been about.
Right. Now, we have a couple of things in common, and more so than you even realize. One of the things we have in common is that Shari Lewis lived in Parkchester, where I grew up, and we were in contact with her. As a matter of fact, once in a while, she would come and babysit for my brother and I. And the second part is that her mother, Mrs. Horowitz, was the music teacher at PS 106, where my brother and I went. And her father, Lewis Horowitz, used to put on magic shows in Parkchester, where we grew up. And I understand that she was influential in your singing career.
she had a vocal class. I think it was something she moonlit and did. I don't believe it was all that she did because she was also a puppet master,
right.
And she also had a fondness for entertainment. And I don't care if all you do is tap dance or all you do is sing or whatever of the arts that you do, you're hooked. You're an entertainment child. You're a student of entertainment and happiness and joy and pleasure. And, you know, so she taught me how to sing. The few lessons my mom could afford to send me over there where she was doing that, I learned how to breathe. I learned how to sing when I was using falsetto. I learned how to smile at the same time I sang, whether I could hit the note or not.
Right.
I learned that it wasn't about making myself sound like anyone else, but to attempt to develop my own specific vocal attitude of music, and as long as it was pleasing to the ear, to do my best to make it work. So I didn't know I was doing that, though, Mike, when I was 2 and 3 and 4 years old, when I was in my crib and I was a baby and went to nursery school. I didn't know that it was something that I would look to earn a living doing. You gotta remember, when I came up as a little boy, there was no black and white TV hardly, or we couldn't afford one.
Right.
And the TVs that we saw people doing stuff that was supposed to be hard. And I saw the juggling acts, everything from Ed Sullivan to all the early Dinosaur, all the early shows that helped develop me as a performer. I don't even use the word entertainer. If I could just entertain myself as a performer, my parents were happy, and it would keep me from going out and getting in any kind of trouble.
Right.
And of course, Harlem went to the Harlem it became later with the drugs. It was tough, though. There was a lot of gangster, mobster activity going on, but not so that it would meet, would reach or affect the mindset of a group of black boys that lived in Harlem next to two white families, an Irish family, a Spanish family. It was like the United Nations in Harlem when I grew up, and that's what Harlem is like today.
Being that I was a dean in a very tough junior high school in the Bronx, I found out that with kids, it all depends on where you point your focus. You could stand in the middle of the gangs and the nonsense and the no good nicks. But if you pointed your focus in another direction, you got through it okay, rather than buying into the nonsense. Now, one thing I wanted to ask you, and I don't know whether other people have touched on this, but it's very interesting as to how you got the name Cuba. You want to tell us
my
that story?
My father was born a slave in Barbados, and of course most people of color who are under British rule in the Caribbean, who was born in 1920 or 30, anything, was brought to that continent to be subservient to British or Spanish rule. And the Spanish, I don't mean Cuba, the Puerto Rican, but I mean Spain. I mean, you know, slavery isn't something that was thought of that was that negatively frowned upon worldwide. Back even before my father was born, and we can go back to the Pharaoh and the Egyptians and all of that. But the truthfulness of it is that my dad didn't like it, which is the only thing that matters in this interview we're having now. He didn't believe that any group of people, particularly his group of people, should be subservient to another. And I don't know where he got it from, because my grandfather and my grandmother, who was my dad's mom and dad, they accepted it as if it was gospel, as if it should be law. And my grandfather was my father's overseer in the fields, and whatever that was done on those plantations there in Barbados to serve the British colonialists. And we, as Goodings, seems to be more Gooding than was that. And right now, if you go on the computer and look, excuse the expression, but Barbados is infested with Goodings.
Right.
Everywhere. I got relatives everywhere. Gooding, and Alston's, and Austin's, and, uh-huh. Oh man, you know what I mean? So the whole concept of that at 16 years old, he was fed up with it and ran away.
Right.
And helped build and ran down the Panama Canal and worked on ships and never developed a specific religion, but his hatred of the British so much because of his circumstance.
Right.
Had him pay attention to a gentleman that's being spoken of on a TV show going on today. They just had a finale, I think, called Boardwalk Empire, where they talk about a guy who's trying to support Marcus Garvey.
Right.
And he, of course, is a villain in Boardwalk Empire. It's on TV, it's on HBO. But,
right.
I mean, you know, it's a true story, and my father became a disciple of his.
Uh-huh.
After he left Cuba because of the, and it had nothing to do with the British. The Italians like the movie The Godfather. The father was, he settled in Cuba after helping build one of the workers on the Panama Canal and they killed his first wife and child. No relation to me, except for the fact that he was my father,
right.
Long after. And they were trying to kill him and his Australian partner, and he fled to America.
Wow.
And his Australian partner went back to Australia. And when my dad got to America, he fell in love with a woman standing on a bus stop waiting for a ride to her domestic job. That was my mother, Miss Annie Austin. And Miss Austin gave him a hard time. He was flirting with her, picking up in the cab, and they fell in love. And they had two opposite ideologies on religion and politics. My mom, who had come out of the South, she was knee-deep into Daddy Grace and Father Divine and evangelistic, what would be called similar to cult-following religious, almost. Maybe it would be called right-wing. I don't know what it would be called today, but whatever it was, she believed in the accepted imagery of Jesus, et cetera, et cetera. My father did not have a religion at all. He believed in black nationalism because Marcus Garvey, who at that time had spearheaded the black nationalist movement, again, which was not necessarily political. He just thought all black people, because of the catching hell, should go back to Africa. And, you know, that crashed and burned for a lot of reasons. But nevertheless, we all, at this point, have had experiences where folks want to leave America, which turned out to be the best place that any of us could be, to accomplish what we could without any other so-called restrictions, according to my father on my deathbed when he died.
Right.
I was 11 years old. I had been fed both ideologies, hardcore Christianity and hardcore black nationalism. And no negative against any other religion had ever come into my mind, but I learned self-defense from both. Therefore, I've always got along with everybody. It's like Cuba Jr. That part of me he picked up. He cannot sing, but Cuba Jr. makes everybody love him because he believes in not picking a side politically or religiously against in any other political position or religious position. And I think that I take full credit for with regard to Cuba Jr. Now, my father met my mother on the bus stop, and when they fell in love, they began to date. My dad was an entrepreneur. He ran he owned two or three taxis because he brought money from Cuba. He did not come a poor man. He came to America as an entrepreneur. He bought three or four rooming houses in the village of Harlem. And my mother then did not have to work as a domestic anymore, and they were living happily ever after. And then I was born, and he said, I love you, I'm going to spend the rest of my life with you, but if a firstborn is a boy, I'm going to call him Cuba, because in remembrance of my first wife and child. So his name will be Cuba Gooding. And my mother fought him tooth and nail. Cuba's mother fought me tooth and nail. Cuba's middle name is Mark. She made me call him Mark until he was old enough to decide that his name really should be Cuba Gooding. But she did. And my mom, and Shirley, who is Cuba's mom, my first wife, she believed similarly, and still does today, to the way my mother believed with regard to religion, not just Christianity, but the evangelistic theory of born-again Christianity. Nothing wrong with it. until somebody dies, you don't know what the right religion is, and I don't condemn, and neither does any member of my family, to my knowledge, condemn any form of religion, because we don't know whether whatever works for you, works for you. Christianity works for me. And so, but my dad didn't pick up any of it, but he taught me enough to have self-respect for myself so that I could survive and not feel abused and not feel downtrodden and not feel as if I should be subservient to any man or woman or belief in my life. I've had a lot of advantages because of that, Mike, because I could see it coming and I knew how to remain neutral. I had a few problems when I was young because I fought for something that most of the children around me, their parents did not have them believe. Plus, my name was Cuba. I had to be able to fight good anyway because my name was Cuba. What made you? Your children can be cruel. What kind of name is that? I had to justify my name being Cuba without even telling the story when I was coming up. And one of the things that helped me bring people to my side was the fact that I was an entertainer. I was a performer. I could sing. I made people laugh without laughing at me. I know how to make people laugh with me. Whether I physically believed in everything they were saying or not, it did not matter. Because I've always loved the common man. Because I wasn't born with a silver spoon in my throat. And these are things that that I learned from my dad. It's a Caribbean mindset. This is why we're doing the movie. It's not like Roots. It's not like an African American. It's not like Color Purple. It's not like Django. None of that. Okay, everything my dad did, he wouldn't even let anybody call him his name. His name was Dudley McDonald Gooding. His father was William McDonald Gooding, and that's from the slavery and the whole thing. But he never let anybody call him anything but Cuba Gooding. And now I've got that badge, and so does one of my sons. And my grandson, middle name, Mason, is Cuba. And none of us speak fluent Spanish. Isn't that a shame? We don't. And then during the Kennedy days, when the Cuban Missile Crisis and everything came, I better be making something positive of myself. And don't do anything illegal if I can help it, because I can't say it was somebody else. It was Cuba that did it. Oh, okay. There he is.
So we're learning about Cuba Gooding, the man. We certainly are.
When he wants to provide. I'm not the one you want, because I'm practically penniless. But I can give you everything you need, and that's love. Now, you know, baby, some people believe that that is enough. But you and I know that's everything that's anything. All I can give you is love. Now, you're the kind of woman that deserves the sun, the moon, and the stars. And I'm doing whatever's within my power to make that possible. But for now, love will just have to do. I'm trying, baby. I'm really trying, and that's what counts.
Now, I don't know whether you realize this or not, but you and I have been in the same room a couple of times as we spoke a few days ago. One of them was years ago when Everybody Plays the Fool came out, and I had a group. I had a group at that time in Long Island, which was a top 40 group. The group was Grand Boulevard, and we opened up for the Main Ingredient out on Long Island at one of the clubs. I would say probably about a month or two after the tune came out. And then let's fast forward to my deanship in the Bronx at Castle Hill Junior High School. And, pretty much I had Michael and Cristalia Gooding as kids that were under my deanship in the school, and I think they were.
Those are my grandchildren.
Absolutely.
Those are my grandchildren.
You bet.
You didn't realize I didn't meet their father until he was 22.
Right.
Thomas, their father was born when I was 17.
Right.
And our parents and grandparents decided that his mother and I should not assume the responsibility of parents, and they could make that decision, and my mom moved me to Philadelphia. Which a lot of folks feel that Cuba Gooding and the Main Ingredient came out of Philadelphia, but no, we came out of New York.
Right.
But, you know, you are a very important, probably even more so than you can even explain to me, you are a very important part of the development of the Gooding brand and the Gooding legacy. Because what is going to happen is, I know sometimes my sons and I and my daughter probably don't want to think about it or admit it, but one day we will die.
Right.
And the baton will have to be picked up by these children that you're talking about, Cristalia, Michael. Then I have a younger son, Omar, and then Cuba Jr. has Spencer and Mason Cuba and Piper. I mean, these 8 or 9 grandchildren of mine, 5 of them have given me 13 additional great children.
Wow.
Great grandchildren.
Wow.
So, We're at a point right now where it's you being, and that's why I was so anxious to give you as extensive an interview as you wished, because you helped my grandchildren in their formative years and might have filled in the blanks for something that I wasn't able to because I wasn't around.
You sat in my office, and so did Tommy, and I think Cuba Jr. was there as well, as a matter of fact, and we were talking about their well-being at that time, and You know, we had a long discussion about getting them a little more focused, if I might say. And I've often wondered how Mike, I mean, I can picture them right in front of me. And as a matter of fact, Chris Dahlia, she told you exactly what she thought. When she used to come into my office, she would look around my office and tell me exactly what was on her mind. I don't believe she's changed.
I don't think she's changed at all. As a matter of fact, the jury is out now, right now, whether or not that is going to be a plus or a minus in the remembrance of them when they leave this earth, because right. I don't see a major amount of success that has come from that attitude that they have right. about being speaking your mind and not worrying about angering people and being arrogant and so forth like that. I don't know if that's a good thing or not, but I do know that if there was any negative in my parenting,
right.
I didn't pick those up because my parents saw to it.
Right.
If there was any negative in me, my kids didn't pick those negatives up, whatever they were, because I saw to it and I showed them that they didn't. Now, when you have kids in this millennium who come up, one of the worst things you can do is lie to them.
Right.
Because this is a computer age, and every child from 4, 3, 2 years old, some of them learn how to sit at that glorified typewriter and punch in what it is they want to know.
Right.
And all of the facts are there in front of them. And it has been awfully scary as to how some of the kids turn out what we might return to as bad. When they find out that they have been misled
right.
and deceived.
Well, you know, I will tell you that I'm retired 10 years, but I did spend 30 years, you know, there in the Bronx in that area. And, mm-hmm. When they say it takes a whole village, you know, teachers can spend the whole day with kids. And, of course, peer pressure is very strong, but you said the word for me. It takes the parents to get involved, period.
That's right. They have to. And if the parents have been deceived at the same time, that's a generation that could be lost. And I don't know. We can't do anything about what has happened, but we certainly can.
Right. I agree.
Trying to have some consideration for the future.
I hear
that's
you.
That's why every song that I have been successful with has told a story. It has made a statement even more so than a story of something that folks understand to be true but can sometimes be ignored in the heat of the drama of the moment. When I said everybody plays a fool, they do. Every time somebody does something illegal or runs or shoots somebody for no cause or stabs someone or runs off and jumps out in front of a car or uses profanity unnecessarily, it's a foolish thing to do, but they do it. And year after year, since 1971, people in America, human beings all over the planet, have agreed that everybody plays the fool, because when they hear the song, they either buy it, sing it along, or download it, or whatever they do with it. Same thing with the new thing that I have out now called Politics.
Right.
Okay. There's nothing that I'm saying in the song Politics that isn't true, and perhaps if there's any broken factions that can be repaired, someone will examine what is actually broken, and there may be a generation or two after you and I have been gone 100, 200 years
right.
that will fix it. I don't know if that can happen with the mindset of those of us that are alive today who are in charge.
Well, you're right,
but I believe that you as an educator, okay, I always believe that you would be one of my biggest assets. All educators
right.
would be a big asset to Everybody Plays a Fool of a song that was used in a different era with music, but everything in entertainment that happens today, positively or negatively, is instructional. And because it is instructional, we have a responsibility as we do entertainment to at least tell the truth. That's the least thing we can do, is tell the truth, because if someone listens to the record 50 years from now or 100 years from now, at least they'll know that the popularity of that music and of that artist and of that writer wasn't some sort of a scam or something that should be ignored. There's music right now. There's a reason why White Christmas does so well every year, over and over again. I'm dreaming of a White Christmas. Okay. It has nothing to do with the complexion of the person or the snow or anything else.
Right.
But it is such a beautifully composed lyric. Just like I said, politics is frightening. There's a lot of other ways to say that, but that hits the nail on the head. It took me 8 years to come up with the right words.
Right.
Politics is frightening. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas. Everybody plays the fool. And we're not stones rolling down a mountainside. God is on our side. You know, I mean, these things I sing best. And right now, I think that it is imperative that we bring back some real rhyme or reason that is musically pleasing to the ear, yet instructional at the same time. What do you think?
Are you interviewing me now? I tend to agree with you. Yes, if you have passion and emotion in the lyrics of a song, you know, and the song comes from your heart and soul, yes, I agree with you. Now, let's clarify for everybody that's listening that politics is a new vocal that Cuba Gooding is responsible for, and this is your new tune.
I wear it. I wear politics as the song. Win, lose, or draw with it financially. Win, lose, or draw with it emotionally. It is a true statement of what politics does to the common man, not in America only, but on the planet Earth.
Absolutely.
It is scary. It is scary in every system, every political system that exists takes the common decision away from the common man who, if you're lucky, have a right to vote. Now, just like I said, so although we vote, we cannot fix deception we know is politics.
Holy Bible told us so.
politics.
Now, there is a lot about that that could have been said. Fingers could have been pointed. Certain parties, right or left, could be blamed. But it does not matter to someone who's working for minimum wage at a food chain. Okay? If he or she is looking to raise themselves up and have the success that Cuba Gooding Jr. had.
Right.
But he or she might have some sort of medical issue or might have a racial dilemma or might have a gender problem with some of those who are making the governmental decisions, okay, and then you don't even get a fair vote or an election is in any way tampered with, that can affect humanity for several years. Okay? It can't be, okay, that's how it was, this is how it is, now everything is better. You know, my dad taught me that based on his nationalistic mindset. Okay? Not that it even, because it was racial, it doesn't matter. It's true. If you don't have a chance to, if there's going to be any way, Mike, that we as normal human beings who are not the super rich or the super poor, you know, I don't think either one has a right to make a final decision for all of humanity. Okay? But politics throws us all into the same pot, and whoever votes makes the vote, whoever is made to vote one way or another, dictates how everything goes. That's politics. You gotta have somebody running things. Don't you?
Yeah.
Or do you?
What was your first group? Cuba.
First group, professionally, it was called the Charades.
Right.
And when I say professionally, this is the first singing group that I recorded contact with, was MGM Records. A guy named Tom Wilson, who happened to be African-American. And of course, it was a total shock to me to find out that Tom Wilson was African-American. But he not only signed the group Charades, myself, George Staley, Howard Fowles, and John Matt.
Right.
And we were street corner singer guys, and we got an MGM contract to do a song called Never Set Me Free. And the public decided not to. And we sold about maybe 9 copies of it. But nevertheless,
sounds familiar.
We were on the same label with Simon and Garfunkel.
Connie Francis.
Paul Simon is in it, and Frida Payne.
Right.
And then MGM was at that time the premier label, and there was no big issue about a Motown then. No Philly International. Everybody was a pop artist.
I hear you.
And that's what I decided that I wanted to be. That was my first recording contract.
Right. Well, what's funny is I had a singing group out in Long Island that had a contract with MGM Records. We cut a couple of tunes in the early 60s, and they kind of got picked with a bullet and did not go anywhere. And the group broke up after that because the guy says, you know what, we don't want to go through this again. They should have stayed with it at that time. Now, when you recorded Everybody Plays the Fool, did you know what you had when you got out of the studio?
No, we hated the song. Buzzy Willis was a guy who used to play basketball with us in Harlem. And he didn't particularly like school, and he didn't feel as if he needed any more education. He went out and got a job, put on a shirt and tie. He could speak well, and he became in charge of black music for RCA Records. RCA at that time knew nothing about any sort of what they would call race music at that time, but they did know black artists did exist, because the only other two black artists that were on RCA Victor at that time was Charlie Pride and Harry Belafonte.
Right, and Charlie Pride, he was influential in your career, was he not?
Yeah, he was very influential, because Charlie Pride was so popular, and being an ex-baseball player and everything else, that the writers who came from the same neighborhood that we did wrote a country western song for Charlie Pride, and he turned it down. He said it was garbage, it's not country. But he gave it to me, and I had to come up with some sort of hit record, and the group's the main ingredient, because Donald McPherson, the original lead singer of the main ingredient, had passed away.
Right.
And so Jerry Weintraub was my manager, and I rather than go over 15 minutes, you can take a look at who Jerry Weintraub was.
Oh, not too shabby.
And is to this industry.
Right.
And he went to RCA, and he said, well, you got to let him do one more album. So we did every song except one. Charlie Pride had turned down Everybody Plays the Fool. And we gave the song to our arranger at that time. I started really a little unfairly to a lot of folks, because I didn't start out recording in my garage. I sang on street corners by choice
right.
at an amateur show. But professionally, after leaving MGM of all places, I went to RCA and had a 40-piece orchestra on every live 40-piece orchestra on every song I sang.
Wow.
We did 20 Minutes Who Can I Turn To, and I did the Everybody Plays the Fool on a 45 donut record.
Darkness will hide me. just what I'm after. My sorrow, beg, steal, or borrow my share of laughter. With you, I'm gonna learn to.
Is, but it was instrumental.
Yeah, they do.
And because we thought it was gone, we didn't think it was anything either that was going to be a hit.
Wow.
So we sang it as straight and as popish as we could. The main ingredient didn't kind of talk. It didn't give an imagery of a Temptations or a Four Tops or a Delphonics or a Shylights. You know, it was not. So no one in the mainstream of the music industry even knew we were African American.
Right.
You know, and so when we went to Europe, Jerry Weintraub put us on tour in Germany and Spain, Armed Forces tour, we came back 60 days later, and we had the biggest record in the country.
Well,
every pop radio station, WABC, Mike, playing it like a national anthem. We came back and said, God, they're playing it. Turn to the black stations.
Well,
nobody was playing it.
Well,
nobody.
Yeah, but my good friend Paco Navarro was playing it on WKTU, and they were playing it. They were playing it on WBLS as well.
Okay. Well, you mean WWRL? BLS was called LIB.
Yeah, I remember.
At that time.
I remember. But okay. That's really
right.
Funny. Now,
I was very fortunate to get into the mainstream. We made a mess of it when Stevie Wonder co-produced Aphrodisiac with us, and we put a naked black woman with an afro on the cover, but we thought it was creatively sound.
Uh-huh.
Now, you can go and bootleg that album and people want $50-$60 for it because the kind of music that we did and the sound and the Stevie Wonder songs and blah, 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 blah,
uh-huh.
blah. But it wasn't until Euphrates River with Just Don't Want to Be Lonely. Then we get back into the supposed mainstream, and then rolling down the mountainside. The '70s was a good time for us.
Who came up with the talking part on Everybody Plays the Fool?
Everybody Plays the Fool. Oh, the talk! I created that right standing in the studio. I hated
okay.
the song so much. I felt the need to explain
because
I guess I've always been hilarious. Why am I even saying this? I thought I'd be an idiot to just start saying everybody plays a fool without some kind of an explanation as to why I would accuse so many people of ignorance.
Well, you know what?
So you're heartbroken. You sit around moping, crying, crying. You say you even thinking about dying? Well, before you do anything rash, dig this. Everybody plays a fool sometimes. There's no to the rule. Listen, baby, it may be factual, may be cruel. I ain't lying. Everybody plays a fool. Falling in love is such an easy thing to do, and there's no guarantee that the one you love is gonna love you.
This is what I know about you, Cuba. You need to come out of your shell and tell everybody how you really feel.
I mean, listen, I'm middle-aged now.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm only in my 60s.
Gotcha.
You know, 9 times out of 10, I got 40 more years to make explanations to people. But I think in order to sell who it is I really would like to remember as being, I better start telling the story now so I can enjoy the super fame and finances that will come with folks knowing, like Sidney Poitier. He doesn't have to do anything else.
Right.
He's fine. He's great. All he's got to do is keep his health.
Right.
Me, I better not miss one interview. Otherwise,
I want to say something. A lot of people don't realize how many tunes Cuba Gooding recorded. When you really dig into the archives and you really do the research to find out how much time Cuba Gooding spent in the studio, there are so many tunes that should have been giant hits that, you know, got a little bit of airplay or maybe got left on, you know, the bottom of the album, or maybe didn't get as much airplay as they should have. But Cuba, you recorded a lot of tunes.
Well, I got to tell you, the reason for some of those that you're talking about that wasn't a hit could be just because of the sign of the times we were in. Of course, we recorded a lot of stuff that you're referring to when disco was coming in. A lot of it when rap was becoming important.
Right.
When profanity was loud, acceptable on the airwaves. And I had a real big dilemma because I was taught to sing by a woman who taught me how to pronounce every syllable.
Right.
Chica Sari Lewis said, if you are ashamed of what you're singing, you should not sing it. If there is a word you're pronouncing that you don't want folks to hear, change the lyric. But there's no reason to mumble a word. I could tell you a few artists that she hated. Rod Stewart was one of them.
Rod
Stewart's biggest success, as far as I'm concerned, based on her opinion of Rod Stewart, was that he did Sanders. And everybody knew, Fly Me to the Moon, everybody knew those. And that's why he had a recent success.
Right.
But as far as Janis Joplin pronouncing every word, it didn't happen. But Nat King Cole did.
Oh, you bet.
Nat King Cole did. Frank Sinatra did. Tony Bennett did.
And
that's who I wanted to. Johnny Mathis did. I wanted to be that.
Johnny Mathis.
See, even scatting in jazz pronounced every syllable.
Johnny.
And so that became unfashionable after a while, and Quincy Jones decided to reach at folks who did not have that economy of direction with regard to being specific, you know. And it wasn't just Quincy, and Quincy might not be the best example of that, but the producers, or even Babyface, one of the greatest producers in the world, you can't understand, or you couldn't understand, you had to hear the record 15 times to understand everything he said. And so I just don't believe that I should, like this, it's not sour grapes that I have a lot of good songs that did not make it, but I sang it the way I felt that it should be sang. I have never had a producer. The only time anyone's ever produced a vocal on me, which is something I hated to do, I sang it in the studio. If I can't hear applause when I finish singing, Sammy Davis will tell you the same thing. I want somebody to clap when I'm finished. My best performance cannot be in the studio in front of a microphone with people smoking cigarettes and having a drink looking at me saying, hey, Cuba, that's great. That's not happiness for me. I'd rather chance doing an amateur show where somebody might throw a tomato and when everybody clap, I say, well, they really must have liked what I did. And I go home with peace of mind. So I am not, recording, making a record, Mike, make sure your readers and your consent, your people understand, that wasn't meant to be a business. It was turned into a business by folks who didn't have those talents to begin with, and to propagate the artist. And the artist recorded, did you see the movie Cadillac Records?
Yes, of
course. It's true. Mm-hmm. With Beyonce? That's true. They made a record just so folks would know they existed so they could go out and earn a living live.
Right.
Now, in the past 50, 60 years, they reversed it and said making the record was more important than having the talent. I could come up with a lot of words, but I don't want to aggravate anybody or make people think that I'm like a sour grapes. But I mean, it got to the point where it depended on more on how you looked than what you sounded like, as whether you would even get a chance, well, how good you could dance.
Very true.
As opposed to how good you sounded. Nina Simone was not a beautiful woman. She was nothing, but she wasn't a beautiful woman. Okay, she would not stand a chance. Sammy Davis wouldn't be given a shot unless he was doing hip hop or running around in Dodgers or singing about drugs with a patch over his eye.
Right.
Today, he never would have been given an opportunity to be the great Sammy Davis Jr. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Johnny Mathis would have made it though. He'd have been fine.
Well,
Johnny,
Johnny told me that when he listened to When Sonny Gets Blue back,
mm-hmm.
After the record had been cut and it was on the radio, he realized that he had sung it wrong. He said, Can't do anything about that, man. It stays, you know, it's now in the archives. Now, we have a mutual friend. This particular person lives in Boca Raton, and he produced an awful lot of people. His name is Dennis Lambert.
Lambert and Potter did all that they could to get a hit record with me based on the directions that they were given. I love them both with all my heart. Dennis Lambert and Brian Potter were two of the most creative people. I even structured a song out of a song that they recorded on me for my son and I to sing together. I wish they were still around and get with me. I'd
put Dennis is still right here.
Dennis, where would I be without you?
Dennis,
they gave me a song that was brilliant. Go ahead.
Dennis is right here in Boca Raton, Florida. I see him all the time. We go out socially, and he's still got his fingers into the music, and he's still around. And I know that he produced some of your stuff. That's why I brought his name up. He's a good friend of mine.
He did the first Cuba Gooding album. He did the first Cuba Gooding album for Motown.
And fro, your eyes quiet me, how much they know. And when the evil forces try to confuse me, you don't let them get their way. You keep the
Wow.
I was going up just to do it. And if you remember, you mentioned to him that I would like to, my son and I sang his song. My son, Cuba Jr., and I, the only song Cuba Jr. has ever sang in its entirety. I have it.
Wow.
I like to get with him, and I like to do it over.
Wow.
And if he co-produces it with me or gets with me and just do it, yes, and I could probably get it in this next movie, the Cuba Gooding story we're getting ready to do.
Cuba.
But I love him to give it. Tell him to give me a call.
I will hook you up.
Something.
I will hook you
do
up.
That.
That's what I do best. As a matter of fact, as soon as we're through doing what we're doing now, I'm going to give him a call and I'm going to tell him what you said.
Hi, this is Dennis Lambert, and you're listening to my good friend Mike Miller on the Harmony Street Show.
Is he with Brian? Well, you're not going to put this in the interview? You're supposed to talk about people. You're supposed to help everybody.
No, I'm going to...
Don't just let it be about you. Anybody, if I speak up, send it to Weintraub. Make sure that he knows that not only am I alive, he's still alive, and kick him when we're doing a Cuba Gooding story. He's one of the villains, I mean, one of the characters in the
Cuba
Gooding story.
Can't take that back. That's all right. We're rolling. I'm going to throw a name at you right now, and I just want your reaction. You ready?
Hello. Go ahead.
Don Cornelius.
Don Cornelius was the angel. What do they say in the Catholic Church? The Protestant saint, or one of the? He was the guy who was responsible for 70s music becoming a reality to the planet Earth. To the planet Earth. I've said this in several interviews before.
Right.
The planet Earth would not have been as aware of people, black kids, singing groups in places like Detroit, Chicago, Harlem, Brooklyn, Queens, Bronx, D.C., Alabama, okay, doing rhythm and blues music. What he did was he put a face on us, because prior to him, it was the radio and there was American Bandstand. And on occasion, Dick Clark, and most of these guys, dear friends of mine, would come with an artist. If the group got big enough, like the Chess got big enough, Tops got big enough, we got big enough to go on there. But then prior to that, it was only Ed Sullivan. And you had to be Michael Jackson.
Right.
And his family. You know, but Don Cornelius, if you have anything resembling a hit record on the radio, they put your face, and he put your face on TV. Folks would wait Saturday morning, 11 a.m. to watch Don Cornelius. I don't know any of, and if I knew, I probably would not want to discuss the reasons behind his demise, health-wise or any other way.
Right.
But I do believe that it is a terrible injustice to those of us who are still earning a living in this business, black and white, that we do not honor him. Honor him.
Right.
For everything that he has done to put a face on us and our music. And that goes from Lionel Richie to everybody. Everybody who is earning a living, even current, if you just came up out of the woodwork today, okay, if you're allowed to get on television and people want, and it's fashionable for folks to see you on TV.
Right.
While you're giving the credit due to American Bandstand, remember that there was a young man with an afro that had a television show called Soul Train that made it possible for all of us to make all of this noise still today. Whether we started in Chicago like me and the OJs did, we started on TV. I remember when the Soul Train was just a little cardboard train that he just waved in front of the thing there. Soul Train!
Right.
You know, before they even had the money for animation.
Right.
Don King did that. And I can't say enough good things about him, and I hope that he is resting well.
Well, you were there right from the beginning on Soul Train. You were on one of the first episodes of Soul Train.
Very beginning, because we say, and it was more important to us than it was to the OJs or any of the, a lot of the other groups, because we were with what was called at that time a white record company. It's like being with A&M in California. You know, it wasn't, we didn't have a black division. There was no, you know, in order for us, once we had everybody play the fool, we were on our own. We had to come out. We needed to come out then with Melancholy Baby, and after that, come out with a rhythmic version of White Christmas or something in order to continue. We had to, in order to reestablish ourselves in the art, the way that the industry viewed itself at that time, we needed to know that we could attract with R&B music, melody and lyrics, and harmony, the rest of the population of this planet with
right.
our music. And that's what we did when Everybody Plays the Fool. Everybody Plays the Fool and the Fifth Dimensions. Would you like to fly on this beautiful balloon? Would you like? We were the only even reasonably thought of crossover pop records. We were
right.
the two artists that was on all, or everything else was doing hardcore R&B,
right.
rhythm and blues.
Right.
You know that, Mike. You
yeah.
know.
Well, you know, hey.
You're at least 40 years old. Were you 40 or 50?
I'm 67, going on 30.
Oh, you're still a teenager like me.
There you go. Well, you know, I say that the Intruders and the Manhattans and all of those groups, that was the mm-hmm. that was the way we continued the doo-wop. And if you say, look, I will tell. Here's another thing about Junior High School 127 Castle Hill. Along with Michael and Cristalia were Jimmy and Paul Keyes, and they were the children of Jimmy Keyes from The Chords, who wrote Shaboom. I think you mm-hmm. know that as well. He was
Shaboom,
a neighbor.
Shaboom, Shaboom.
Oh, by the way, as luck would have it, we ate dinner last night because we have so many leftovers. And of course, mm-hmm. we're taking my wife Paulette's parents out as we do every Sunday. They're 87, and we go to this favorite Italian restaurant. And so it's just like too much food, but food is my drug. But anyway, even though I'm in good shape, last night we're searching through the TV and I'm waiting for the boxing to come on HBO, whatever. And I'm skipping around and I'm saying, oh, looky there. It's Jerry Maguire. So we watched Jerry Maguire. And,
That's all over Capel.
He's all over everywhere. While I was on, just doing some Cuba Gooding research, and I kept stumbling across his Academy Award acceptance speech, and it probably goes down as one of the best.
And the Oscar goes to Cuba Gooding Jr. and Jerry Maguire.
Bit of time, so I'm going to rush and say everybody, and you cut away. I won't be mad at you. Tom said, don't forget to thank your wife. I will never forget to thank my high school sweetheart and the mother of my children, Spencer and Mason. I love you, Sarah. And my parents who are here, Shirley and Cuba the First. And God, I love you. Hallelujah. Thank you, Father God, for putting me through what you put me through, but I'm here and I'm happy. I just want to, here we go, okay, the studio, I love you, and Cameron Crowe, and Tom Cruise, I love you, brother, I love you, man, Derek Crowe, Sean Settles, Keith Butler, all my behind-the-scenes crew, Regina King, I love you, you did a great job when we made the movie, everybody involved with the movie, I love you, oh, here we are, I love you, I'm going to keep going, Harley Junior Agency, everybody.
Oh yeah, it was the first, it is probably the most enthusiastic with regard, with the exception of what Little Richard did.
Right.
when he got his, I believe it was American Music Award or Soul Train Award or something like that years ago, he said that, you know, I want to present this award to me. Me. Nobody ever gives me anything. Me. Little Richard was a funny guy. And he used to live, Little Richard actually used to live in a hotel, the Hyatt, on Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles. And Stevie Wonder was living there for a while, too, but that was the epitome of Hollywood. Not Beverly Hills, but Hollywood, even though it was on the cusp of Beverly Hills. And these guys, real regular guys, folks, that's why their music and their careers have spanned so long, because they were like regular folks.
Yeah, but Cuba Gooding Jr. You know,
so that's a good thing. Anyway, so let's go on to the next question. Here we go.
I just want to say, too, Cuba Gooding Jr., you know, was the only one that when they try to play him off with the music, they gave up and they let him keep speaking.
Junior really, really had rebelled against doing the supposed singing scene with the glasses in Jerry Maguire. He was wearing the sunglasses and he was supposed to be singing.
Right.
And he refused to do it until he knew I wasn't gonna be anywhere around. You know, I had been there on the set for about a week and a half straight, just loving it, hanging out, Tom Cruise, talking to everybody, talking trash, and blah, blah, blah. And the one day that I had to leave to go to a gig, he said, okay, let's film the singing scene now. And he did, you know, and it turned out to be great. Of course, he's not a singer, of course, or the singing that he can do, he won't do, because he doesn't feel as if he does. Well, I had a song he and I sang together with them. That was written by Dennis Lambert.
Right.
Of Lambert and Potter, who did my Cuba Gooding album at Motown.
Well, as I said, we're going to hook
called,
that
Where
up.
Where Would I Be Without You? Father and Son. Where Would I Be Without You? I'm going to put this on my next album, too. But anyway, go ahead.
Okay, now let me ask you something. Did you at one time sing with a group called The Poets?
No, The Poets was a group of my dear friends in the neighborhood of Harlem that I grew up with. Donald McPherson. Donald McPherson was the lead singer.
Right.
Luther Simmons and Tony Sylvester.
Gotcha.
Who after Donald McPherson passed away, I joined the Main Ingredient to replace him temporarily while he was ill. Nobody had any idea he had leukemia and he was going to die. Once he did, then I actually joined the Main Ingredient as a matter of faith and convenience.
Gotcha.
Well, convenience / fate, because I always wanted to be a professional singer. And these guys made a deal with RCA Victor before I had even joined the group. I was on the road selling encyclopedias, magazines from door to door. Just spent a couple of years of college.
Wow.
It was not my intention at that time to ever join a singing group, because my passion was to emulate Nat King Cole, Sam Cooke, Frank Sinatra, Tony Bennett. That's the kind of singer my mom wanted me to be. That's why she supported me at all times, sang at all the graduations, blah, 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 in church. I didn't do a lot of church singing, and when I did sing in church, it was only the Lord's Prayer.
Wow.
It's the only one that I felt that my kind of voice could fit into, particularly in the black church. For me to try to sound like C.C. Wyman, somebody like that, that wasn't going to happen. You know, so I just decided I was just going to sing the Lord's Prayer, and that was enough for me. And I still was studying my craft of being a straight up and down, understand every word, clarity of voice, you know, singer, crooner, if it were. It depends on how you say it.
Gotcha.
But yeah, The Poets had a Merry Christmas Baby. The Poets evolved into the Main Ingredient and became, they had Spinning Around, I'm So Proud, but their first song ever resembling a hit was You've Been My Inspiration. We still perform that form. We perform that today in concert.
She runs back into you.
away in 1970, I had to pick up the baton, and they said, you better come with another hit record, otherwise your contract is up, and you're finished here at RCA. A lot of pressure on us. So we took this country western song, While Everybody Plays the Fool, and grudgingly put it on the album called Bittersweet.
Right.
But then they didn't release the album right away. We were not worthy. So they just released a single called Everybody Plays the Fool. And we actually were very disappointed. We went on tour for 2 months in Europe, Armed Forces tour, Germany, Spain. We came back, we had the biggest record in the country. Wasn't even aware that it was being played in the United States on all the pop stations. You know? And so that's why the song you just mentioned, Who Can I Turn To?
Right.
That was done because of my love and fondness for Tony Bennett and his version of Who Can I Turn To? And
right.
We put harmony and background behind it and gave it to our arranger, Mr. Bert DiCattolo, who came up with a fabulous, we thought that was, she said, that should be the single. So we put it on the flip side of Everybody Plays Fool. And
yeah,
it did get a lot of recognition.
Yeah.
Even then, we had to do Who Can I Turn To in doing Everybody Plays the Fool, because that was the mega hit.
Yeah, that was a great tune.
You
will hide me. What I'm after.
Find what I'm after.
I'll throw off my sorrow, beg, steal, or borrow my share of laughter.
There's a tune called You Got to Take It. Tell me about that tune.
If you want it, you gotta take it. If you want it, you gotta take it.
Hey, baby. Come over here and sit down and let me rapture you for a minute. I don't want you to think I'm conceited or anything, but I've been through quite a few changes. So if you really want me, you just got to take my. So you know if you really, 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 really want my love,
tell it like it is.
This is what you got to do. Take it,
take it,
take it with kindness and sweet consideration. Take it with
you
want it, you know you got to
take it
from me.
take my love. Another infatuation, baby.
That was off the...
was written by a guy named Ed Townsend.
Right.
Ed Townsend also co-produced and wrote Let's Get It On by Marvin Gaye.
Right.
Which follows What's Going On by Marvin Gaye. He was our producer for a whole album called I Only Have Eyes For You. You know, Ed Townsend was a singer in his own right when he was younger in those days. He had sang a song called For Your Love, oh, I would do anything. You know,
great
For
tune.
Your Love, also a big hit. He really loved, he appreciated my ability to do a ballad. You know, see, in those days, Mike, were very special in our industry because there was a determination by all of the artists, whether it was rock, acid rock, or if it was pop or Hispanic, everybody tried to have their own identity. It got to the point in the 80s and 90s where everybody wanted to sound alike. But we were all determined that I think the main ingredient was able to squeeze in on the top 5 and top 10 of the charts, Billboard, Cashbox, and Record World and everything else, because we didn't sound like anyone else. But still, we gave... paid homage to what we referred to as ear candy, music that was pleasing to the ear, to the ear rather, because you know it had gotten to the point, particularly with disco and a lot of rock and roll, the drums were more important than the vocals.
Right, we had great vocals in the group.
We never subscribed to that. A lot of the hits that we've had, a lot of the stuff in Dallas that we did, all the drums were doing were keeping time. That's all the drums. The drums were not used to like lead the whole attitude. And if people danced, they danced for the voices, the attitude, and the excitement of the vocals and the words that were being used, not necessarily to the drums. That was reversed when Euro Disco came in. And but you know, who can I turn to? I'm glad you brought that up because it was the flip side of the 45. Was what? That's how you released the record, 45.
Right.
And then before that, it was the 78.
Hey, listen.
You know?
I have, when I met my wife, she had a 57 Seaberg jukebox in the living room, and she calls it the family room. I call it the living room, but 200 45s, and Everybody Plays the Fool is among the 200 records, so that's pretty good. She's pretty eclectic, but she loves her music, so that's pretty cool.
How flattering that is.
Hey, only 200 out of all those millions. Tell me about the Aphrodisiac album.
Aphrodisiac was co-produced by Stevie Wonder because Stevie Wonder and a member of our group named Tony Sylvester became friends through Stevie's brother. And he hounded them. First time we came out to California, after Everybody Played the Fool with a hit and we were getting ready to work on the Euphrates River album, we decided that it was important that we had an African-American identity.
Right.
You must remember that we're the only, everybody plays the fool being what the song that the world knew us by. There were a lot of black stations still that were not playing any of the other stuff or ethnic things that I sang on the album called Bittersweet. And we wanted to be able to tour with the likes of the Isley Brothers and Stevie Wonder, Stylus and shit. We just wanted to fit into our neighborhood. We were young and we felt that even though we had conquered the pop market, we also want to be known as R&B as well. I'll tell you another group that felt the same way. They were called the Fifth Dimension.
Right.
The Fifth Dimension. They were as pop as it could get. And a lot of these folks, I mean, not only did they have an orchestra, but Billy and Marilyn and all those guys, they could read music. All of their vocals, as well as their music, instrumental music, was written for them.
Wow.
So they were a living orchestra.
Tight harmony.
It wasn't like, you know, the harmony was just incredible. We used the orchestra arrangement to complement our vocals, but there was never any more than three of us singing.
Right.
You see, we might use five or six tracks of Overdub, but we would never use more than three singers so we could duplicate it on stage.
Right.
We didn't want to have to pay a fourth or fifth person to sing. Matter of fact, if you don't see but three people on the album cover, those are the three people that are singing.
I got you.
You know, we took a great deal of pride in doing that. So when Stevie Wonder said that he wanted us to do a couple of his songs, because we were hot then, and he was a firecracker as always, but he said, I got a song called I Am Yours. It's a ballad, you guys singing in three-part harmony, we can pull it off.
Open up your heart.
We did. That was on the Aphrodisiac album. He had another song called Girl Blue that he had done fast. It was a fast song. Fair no morning, good, good morning.
Sunrise above, little girl, you're sad. The wall you have is visible to you. Within your heart, there stays a part that, like the sky, is blue.
To pronounce the words clearly and sing it as a ballad. Hello, morning.
Right.
Good morning. You know, and one thing led to another. Before you know it, we had another song called You Can Call Me Rover.
Mm-hmm.
gonna love you all over.
From that when we performed overseas in London and in Europe, and that was written by the same guys who wrote country western songs for Charlie Pride called Everybody Plays the Fool. So, you know, we're all one big musical community in New York City in those days.
Right.
And we only went to California for one reason and one reason only, to do a couple of shows. We had no desire to do anything but go back and forth from New York, from the East Coast, back and forth to Europe. Going to California to perform wasn't a place where, unless we did Greek theater or one of the big places where we could earn a living. You know, it wasn't easy for us to do because we weren't country western. It was a different thing. And then all of a sudden, bam, Don Cornelius pops up, and he has a whole bunch of a big following in Hollywood, Soul Train, the TV, and then American Bandstand. After doing those shows, then we became nationwide for real.
Right.
But Aphrodisiac was lost in the sauce. Do you know why? RCA Victor did not know how to sell what you would call black or ethnic music.
I agree.
At that time.
Their
promotion was for the only three black acts they had at that point, Ty Belafonte, Charlie Pride, and yours truly.
Wow.
And so they were a bit disappointed as well that we came with an album called Aphrodisiac with a naked black woman on the cover with a afro, regardless to who were they, wouldn't have cared if Frank Sinatra produced it himself. That wasn't something that their promotional routine
right
in those days and for overseas was geared to do. And there may have been other reasons too, but it was a secret until 2 years later. The Aphrodisiac album was a secret. The only thing I could do with the Aphrodisiac album on stage and live performance is we'll start out singing Girl Blue Fast and announce it as Stevie Wonder song and then do a slow version so that it would add to the legacy of the ability of the main ingredient to sing ballads.
The bootleggers were making more than RCA on the album.
Oh, of course. You see, the idea of Motown existed at the same time, and Smokey and those guys coming out with R&B, and then, of course, they had Philly International and Gamble Huff and all those guys and the OJ, they were perfecting R&B music, and then you had Sylvia Robinson and Joe Robinson in New Jersey with the Moments. You know, there was a lot of competition.
Right.
For black music, we never had to compete. We never had to compete to earn a living with all of the other artists that were doing what they were doing with regard to the R&B station, Pop, and Philadelphia, and Chicago, and all of that, because we had a built-in following from a crossover national point of view. We did a lot of work overseas and all of that. And it was very comfortable, and the older we got, the more comfortable it became.
And all of a sudden, I Just Don't Want to Be Lonely, which was a monster
tune.
That's
the Euphrates River album. That's what we did. We went in that direction just to make sure we could compete.
Hey, say, wait a minute. Where are you going with that suitcase? Hey, wait a minute. Listen. Well, you don't have to answer. Just listen. I don't mind when you say that you're going away. I just don't want to be lonely. And I don't care if we share only moments a day. I just don't want to be lonely. I'd rather be loved.
Wasn't as nitty gritty as normal R&B because we did Summer Breeze, Seals and Crofts.
shining through the window. Let me know everything's all right.
Them at a gig, and we said, you know, we're the cover queens. We just covered Who Can I Turn To and a few other pop songs, and said, now you got Just Don't Want to Be Lonely. We covered that, and that was originally by Ronnie Dyson, and well, Isaac Hayes had done it, so we said, well, let's put our stamp on Work To Do by the Average White Man and the Osley Brothers, and put our stamp on the Summer Breeze. And it's like, you know, like we had the Euphrates River album.
I got work to do.
My shield and claw.
Closer. the longer you fade in. I guess I'll walk along the Euphrates, talking about the river, the deep, deep river, the wide, wide river, cold, cold river, the spiritual river. I said the water's cold.
You know, and so having that kind of relationship with the pop market became very, very easy for us to continue to earn a living and do the things that we were doing. But, you know, somehow we kind of like, at some point or another, I felt like we were getting lost in the sauce. So in 63...
Yeah.
In 76, rather, we came out with an album called Rolling Down the Mountainside.
Right.
Rolling Down the Mountainside refurbished our careers all the way over again. Tony Sylvester quit. He became a big producer for CBS, you know, but we've had it's a very interesting story, the main ingredient. I'm glad you're asking me these questions.
Oh, absolutely. And the other thing I notice is that you work with such fabulous musicians on every tune. As I search through the archives, there are no tunes that are underproduced. They're all produced beautifully with fabulous musicians. Who was responsible for picking those musicians? And did you work with specific musicians over the years that were part of your...
No, the musicians solicit artists that are successful. At that time, all of these fabulous musicians you're talking about were just studio musicians.
Right.
They weren't known as being fabulous musicians. We had a relationship with Seals and Croft. We had a relationship with Stevie Wonder. We had a relationship with Curtis Mayfield. Okay, all of us were still hustling and struggling at that time. And any voice or any sound of any group that they believed that they could possibly come up with a hit record, they go to the record company and request to play on our album. First,
right.
We had arrangers that would pick and choose musicians for us. We had a budget of $250,000 per album. You know, a lot of times we'd have people playing for us that we didn't even know that was fabulous. There were fabulous guys. I had Luther Vandross, who sang the additional backgrounds with some girls, gave us the girls to sing to back us up on Make It With You and Summer Breeze and a few of the other things. And I worked with everyone. And everyone eventually does work with everybody else if you're a popular singing group. Now, when you stylize yourself and you say you only do Hispanic or you only do R&B, hard R&B, or you only do blues, there are a family of musicians that work with them as well. But you must remember that the reason why we have such a bevy of name musicians that play for us, because at that time they may not have been made like Ray Parker Jr.
Right.
Was not a name musician or a name artist at that time, but after having it, John Legend would have played for us then. If John Legend was just starting out writing songs
right.
and trying to earn a living.
Right.
So, I mean, but it was a cooperative thing. Now they've put a lot of the new, young John Legends and Ray Parker Jr.'s out of business because of a machine called a computer.
Right.
You can create an entire orchestra in your garage and make it sound as authentic as it needs to be without using these special musicians. And you can go back into my era and play 70s music and learn how to duplicate every single instrument. So it put a lot of guys out of work, put a lot of kids today out of work. So many of them who might have been master musicians went into rap, gangster rap, and went into a different genre because they couldn't run out and earn a living as rappers, and a lot of them couldn't sing. They played instruments, and they had to go into production. And it was all, everything, I don't know if it was by design, but it's not like it was when we came out. We had a blessed period. If I had a couple of youngsters, three, four guys in the same group today, and I had a lot of money, I wouldn't use a machine on doing anything with them. I'd use a full orchestra, because what it does, what that orchestra did was it taught me how to sing with an orchestra, which now is almost unheard of for most of the youngsters that are out today. But it prepared me. I mean, we did Carnegie Hall five times before we even did Just Don't Want to Be Lonely. We did Carnegie Hall. You know, that's a big deal for some African Americans from Harlem who used to sing on a street corner. All of a sudden, we're in Madison Square Garden. All of a sudden, we're doing all the major rooms in Washington, D.C., Chicago, Detroit, and Philadelphia, because we sounded like the music sounded, and the promoter paid for orchestras to play behind us and the OJs and the stylistics and the Shylights, because that was right before they created these machines to replace human beings.
Right, I agree.
On the stage. And I'm not saying this is sour grapes. I'm telling you what the truth is. And in this interview, this is important that these points are made right now, and there are a lot of guys like a Frank Sinatra and Nat King Cole. They never played with anything, sang with it, but orchestras. Okay, Henry Mancini was also an RCA artist. And it's that kind of character that seems to be lost on many of the current artists today. Of course, once you become as big as Christina Aguilera, Puffy or P. Diddy, whatever he calls himself these days, or if you have a youngster named Bruno Mars, okay, because they sold so many records, they could afford to come up with $100,000, $140,000 to put an orchestra together and tour with it. And you do that when you leave America. As an American, you go out of the country and you tour with that same kind of excellence, because promoters want their orchestra, they want their people to be able to play these in an orchestra. It's really a big deal. It's a little disappointing for me, but it's good to know that you, Mike, can, through me, chronicle the difference between what was happening in the movie Cadillac Records and what happened when I came up, and then compare that to what is happening now with the new artists. There's 1,500 to 2,000 Frank Sinatras and Nat King Coles and Stevie Wonders lined up every year that don't even get to audition for American Idol and The Voice and X Factor. And they don't know what else to do. A lot of them, if they're not talented at anything else, they become minimum wage workers. Okay? But they could give to the world an additional brilliance of music and melody, like Curtis Mayfield did, and like Teddy Pendergrass did. He would have never, I mean, you know, if Hal Melvin and Blue Notes and if Stevie Wonder had to physically audition on today's reality show, their careers would depend on the mindset of someone like Simon as to whether or not he would even move up to the next level to compete to even get a restricted recording contract. And that would have nothing to do with people hearing the record on the radio, because there is no radio for artists that have not been successful with one record. there are a lot of artists that you would hear on the radio every day, because, and it was always on in this country, that disqualified themselves because they did not have the talent than the other few did. Then you have the charts. I mean, this is important stuff. Trying to give you everything that needs to be said to the next several generations of Nat King Cole's and John Legend's.
We're okay? Listening.
Without a radio, you go to the chart, and every back in the 70s and early 80s, at least 2,000 or 3,000 pieces of new material was submitted to American radio, okay, every month, but there was only a top 100. Okay, how can you need to tell me, out of all of those people submitting music, there was only a top 100 every month that people decided that they should choose from who should be the next star?
I understand. It's, well, you know, it's like everything else. The cream rises to the top, and there's only...
To the top.
Right.
To the top. But then again, there's a lot of cream that get diluted with milk.
But it's not always. But it's not always about the most talented. Unfortunately, record companies years ago had, you know, their hand in deciding, you know, politically which tunes became the best. The same thing with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It's all political, you know.
Well, we had a division. Well, we had a derivative of that back in our day too. I mean, you know, do you think anybody would have signed Janis Joplin to a contract to? After she performed what she did on Rod Stewart either. I mean, do you think these guys didn't need some sort of political assistance in order for their music or their songs to get enough publicity to give them enough steam to become stars and to be able to earn a living? Do you think Joe Cocker, who sang You Are So Beautiful,
right,
would get a standing ovation on American Idol today or on The Voice? I don't think so.
No, I hear you.
So James Brown, do you think James Brown would have been thought of as a vocalist of any kind? You know, Mick Jagger was a band. It was a movement. The Rolling Stones. It was different, you know. And so these kinds of opportunities now are far and few in between when it comes to the young coming, and that's what I'm concerned about.
Yeah,
I'm concerned about tomorrow's people. Go ahead.
Let me ask you an important question, okay? And I've had this discussion with many, many performers who I've spoken to, and that is this. As far as record companies go and how you produce a record and where you put that record, it's all changed because, I mean, even my stuff that I record, and I've done a few projects recently, what am I going to do? Put it on iTunes and Amazon for 99 cents? It's changed. What do you do?
You don't know how to sell it.
What do you do Sorry. With a new tune?
What you do with a new tune is be a performer before you even write one. What you do is look at the industry as being a talent and something that you are looking to perfect in by all means possible. Not just, well, I'm a singer, or I'm just a songwriter, or I'm just a this, or you gotta do it all, because the philosophy of my company that's been in existence now for 25 years is you can't sell a secret. And I began to lose track of how to sell products, and a lot of stuff that I wrote maybe 12 years ago or 13 years ago, with the exception of politics, the politics song that I have now with the statement, the melody, and the perfect timing for a song to come out. I mean, that's an exception. That's a blessing. But to have hit record after hit record the same way the Stylistics and Stevie Wonder and everybody did years ago, in order to have that kind of blessing, you can't get that through going through a machine. You don't know who is listening.
Right.
There's no way to promote for a specific market. It has to be such a magnet, an ear magnet, that anything that's sold over the internet today has got to be drummed into you, not only in the computer, but on whatever subscription radio exists, whatever live performances you can give. I mean, there's no such thing as I discovered
right.
Cuba Gooding singing on a street corner anymore and made him a star. He has to get visibility, which means that it has become more than ever a corporate entity. There are radio stations around the country that is playing stuff that perhaps you and I, if we heard it the first or second time, we wouldn't like it, or we wouldn't think it's anything exceptional. But it's being played every day, all day long, on certain radio stations and pushed on the internet 24/7.
Right.
For 2 months, 3 months, 5 months, you end up investing whatever it is that costs to go on iTunes and all of that. Month after month, it can be a year before your record is discovered is a hit.
That's true. You
can continue to put it up there until enough people decide, well, maybe it should be considered to start out and go on the charts.
Right.
Maybe. Let's see if we can get someone to pay us to go through the effort to do that. And the individuals in between the artist and the national and international public. Understand what I'm saying now? This isn't an American issue. This is a business issue. Between me with the song politics and the people that would buy it and be interested in listening to an album is a whole army of people that want to be paid first.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I got you.
And so this whole concept of who's the best and who isn't the best, and to have some of these folks make a decision on a talent show, which is also a reality show.
You got that right.
Decide the fate of an artist,
yep.
I think, is criminal.
Me too.
But that's only my opinion.
I agree with you 100%. And you know what? They destroy the careers of a lot of talented kids who put their tail between their legs.
Kids. That's right.
You know? And really and truly, you know yourself that people have won on American Idol that didn't deserve to win. So
that's right. That's right. You know. Even the American public, for other reasons other than whether or not they were the best,
right,
will vote. And of course, I don't know. I don't get to count the votes. I don't think you do either.
That's true.
So we don't know whether or not the voting is. If voting can be tarnished in a political system, my God, what do you think it is with regard to people being paid by corporations to see to it that an artist is successful or not successful?
Amen,
that is,
brother
Cuba. That's basically where it is. One never knows. So we're in a position right now where the only reason I'm pushing any of my new music, my old music speaks for itself.
You got that
but
right.
But I'm pushing new music because I believe that politics makes a statement, gives an awareness, is a true story, and is something that will help future generations understand the times of which I live. And I believe that's very important. I believe when Cuba Jr. said, "Show me the money," he was just saying it within the context of the script.
Right.
But show me the money, okay, became a theme for years after 1995 of what people would say with regard to doing business in America.
Right.
And probably the world. People know, have forgotten the name of the movie, but they remember the phrase, "Show me the money." And everyone remembers the song, title, "Everybody Plays the Fool."
Hold on 1 second. I got a call coming in. I don't want it to. My wife.
Okay, no problem.
My wife will answer that in 1 second. Come on, honey. Get the phone. Now she's got it. Let me ask you this now. In your heart and in your mind, you want the Cuba Gooding story to be told. So Everybody Plays the Fool. Is the Cuba Gooding story, how are you going to get that story out there?
The machine that fuels any work in progress, entertainment or otherwise, in this country is a long and tedious one. I know everything there is to know for myself with regard to singing. As far as journalism, as far as selling a book, as far as telling my life story, that has got to be done under the adage of what I said before, you can't sell a secret. I believe that, and I've got a couple of people working on it, a couple of appearances on late night TV, whether it's Jay Leno or Lucinda Hall or Jimmy Fallon, doesn't matter. Mentioning it will tweak enough interest by producers and publishers and movie people to realize the fact that it needs for someone to take a look at the story. It has to be looked at, and someone has to agree we're going to put this film into production for the kind of dollars that will do it justice, and they have to believe that it will work. Just like folks who are helping me with the internet, folks that are doing interviews, folks putting me on a TV show, they believe politics cannot miss if it is released to the world now. Okay? It's not something that is not timely. It's the same thing with the film. The Cuba Gooding story may need to be about a current Cuba Gooding.
Right.
Not just an actor who saw, about 10 years ago got an Academy Award. Because, you know, we're what have you done for me lately, lately? What have you done for me lately kind
right.
of people
right.
here. You know, it's when was your last hit record? We even had that back in the 70s. But the idea of it is the promotion of the existence of the Gooding family is unnecessary unless we're talking about something currently that we're doing. That's why Cuba Gooding every month is releasing a new movie, foreign film.
Right.
Every minute he releases new stuff all the time. 2 weeks ago he was just in New York at a film festival talking about a new film that he's releasing. He's got to do it. Okay, only Sidney Poitier can continue. To Denzel Washington, if he comes with no movie 5 years from now, folks will wonder whatever happened to him.
Right.
This is America. This is the way it goes. So my way of talking about the Cuba Gooding story cannot be, I can't get everybody who's watching me on TV on the Jay Leno show to read the synopsis. And if they read it and they say they like it, that's not going to make it go into production any faster. It may be the toughest business in the world outside of the music industry in order to get a home run. That's why, based on the population in this country, it is such a difficult business to do, other than the music business, which is also very difficult.
Hold on.
But it's the business, but you know, it makes sense to do it. So I have no specific answer,
yep.
But perhaps someone who sees this interview, someone who sees me on a TV show, someone who listens to and goes on the internet will decide, you know, I really want to know more about it because we got a budget. It'd be a good idea now that I know more about the Gooding family and how he got his name. And he's still up and happening right now and blah, 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 it'd be a good idea. But that's all I can say. There is no roadmap to measure. There are thousands of people who earn a living in this country who do branding and everything else. That's the safest business to do, branding. I can sell the Gooding brand faster than I can to do something faster than I can sell the song Politics.
Right.
But the Gooding brand, along with the song Politics, the Gooding brand, along with one of Cuba's, because he got 6 or 7 of them he just released over the past 90 days.
Right.
Okay. Might sell one of those 6 or 7 and give it, look at Sylvester Stallone, 8 years to sell the script for Rocky.
Right.
8 years.
I hear you.
You see, so we're in a position right now where there are no quick fixes, and maybe there are, and we will be called overnight successes once it's on a billboard at Times Square. Then we'll call over at them. I never heard of him before. Said, oh yeah, my mother used to listen to his music. Oh yeah, you mean that's Julia's father?
I hear you.
You see, that's how it will go. And I'm being as honest as I possibly can with you because to tell you anything else will be disingenuous. And being disingenuous right now, as much as is at stake, particularly with the lyrics of Politics and the legacy of my family. These are important issues that have to be done with as much transparency and honesty as possible. And if these products are as good as we believe they are, and the public can at least get to see or hear them, they will agree. And it'll be mission accomplished. And then we got to start all over again with the next project, because this is who we are. This is what we do.
Right. But I'm going to make a statement, actually. And my statement is this. You know, being a big Cuba Gooding Jr. fan that I am, because what a talented, talented individual. But if not for Senior, then we wouldn't have Junior. So that's
bless your heart. Thank you.
You know, I mean, obviously he has your genes, and it's all good. Is there anything that we haven't spoke about that you would like to talk about?
I would just like to add to what you just said. I believe that parenting is the second most, other than breathing, parenting and planning on how you're going to parent your children before they're born or after they're born. It depends on when you come to this realization.
Right.
The educational system cannot raise your child. The only thing that can teach a child the difference between right and wrong, good and evil, success and failure, is the parents that give birth to that child. And it's a heck of a responsibility, because there are a lot of babies that look to raise babies. A teenager, 16, 13 years old,
right,
who is pregnant, I don't know, it has happened, and there are a lot of examples that it has happened, but it's not the norm that they can raise a Barbara Streisand.
Well,
you know, it's kind of difficult for someone to believe that. And the idea is to tell them the truth. And I believe that I still have a responsibility, and I almost learned this too late about parenting. Of course, parenting has a lot to do with marrying well on both sides, the male or the female. Okay, and because you can't make up your mind that you want to spend the rest of your life with someone.
Right.
When you're 17 years, 16 years old. 17
Amen.
Years old. My first son was born. You know, I was 17. You remember, you could do that in those days,
yeah.
You know? But the reality of it is, here's what I want to add to what you just said, your statement. I am still parenting. I'm 69 years old.
Right.
I take care of myself and my health and my family. I'm the oldest in my bloodline. Everyone's got to know and believe in their heart that there is life after 60.
Right.
There is life after 70. There are accomplishments that you can make up until 80 years old. Now, all of us are not as dismissed. Some of us are more disciplined than others. And there's such a thing as a Holy Spirit, no matter what religion you do, who decides. It's written down somewhere when we're going to leave this planet.
Right.
But to quit at 40, to give up at 30, to say I can't do this anymore because I'm too old at 50, is a tinge of brain damage. Okay, and I want to make sure that my children and my family, that's why I keep going. I keep doing it. I'm interviewed. I get a lot of, I'm always asked every time of the interviews that I do, they ask, well, how did you do what you, my wife and I had no idea what we were doing. Okay, Cuba Jr. was born after April was born. And then we got into the mindset of parenting. We made some mistakes and we had some successes. I believe we had more successes than we made mistakes.
Right.
Okay? But the whole idea is I take credit for still being alive, showing them that this is what they have to do. Move forward. Like they say on one of the TV shows, move forward. Always think about moving forward.
Right.
It's not over. If you get ill, if you're like, I saw a lady this morning on TV who was from Haiti, who lost a leg in the bombing in Boston. She moves forward. She's got an artificial leg and she's on television as an example to Bostonians as to what can happen if you put your mind to
right.
it and you never give up.
Right.
That's a big deal.
Well,
that is a big, big deal. And for those of us who are 50s, 60s, and 70s, and the doctor is, and the doctor hasn't got you in a wheelchair yet, you have work to do. No, I agree. You, there are things, if you have children, you are still parenting. You don't have to call them every day. They don't have to do everything you say. But as long as they're aware of what you are doing, they will know that they must keep going, because they're going to be disappointed a lot. Well, every human being has disappointments. And you got to move forward.
Well, let me ask you this. What would you like to say to Cuba Gooding fans that have followed you from the beginning and are still following you and would still come out and sit in the orchestra of a theater to watch you perform, buy your new CD? What would you say to those people that have been in your court all those years?
Please continue to pay attention to what I'm doing. The best is yet to come.
That's wonderful. So, Cuba, thank you so much for spending time with me and giving us the real Cuba Gooding, because I'm sure that we found out things about you that most people did not know. You're a man of many, many words, and you're very articulate, and I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your thoughts and being my friend. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Your friendship is probably more important than anything else, because a lot of folks, there are people who don't really have any, or at least they don't believe they've ever had any, and to call you a friend is a blessing for me. To be able to give you my opinions in this interview is a treat and a privilege for me as an entertainer and as a human being. You're a decent human being. I'm a human being. That's all we'll be remembered for, unless we hit home runs in this world, and none of that is guaranteed. So I thank you. Thank you for having me at least chronicalize, if that's the right word, the right word here, chronicalize my views on the entertainment industry and family in general.
Thank you so much, Cuba.
Thank you. Have a good day. Bye.
All right, buddy.
Open up your heart, recall how it used to be, remember all the love we found.
Ooh. On Harmony Street, ooh, there was a place
we
that we used to go, when we were feeling down
and we were alone. On Harmony Street.